Good afternoon. The hearing is resumed. The next item relates to the section 106 for local wildlife sites and landscapes of distinction. We see that that's included within the agreement. Ms. Coombs may have one or two questions on that.
No, I think the questions I had are adequately covered in what we've seen in the Section 106 agreement, and I understand from what Mr. Riley said, if there's any differences of opinion, then we'll see those in the submission tomorrow.
You would, but I don't think there are any on this okay. topic.
Thank you. And so we could move on to 7.5, which is Hallam Marsh, and similarly, unless any other parties have questions, I've got no further questions on that. Likewise, the contributions to knowledge, that's shown in the Section 106 agreement. Ken Moore, the tilting weir. I note in the Section 106 agreement that it's in consultation with Natural England, but I believe we had a representation from the Environment Agency about, or maybe it was at an issue-specific hearing, wanting to ensure that they were satisfied with the aims of the project in terms of better flow management. So I just wonder, maybe the Environment Agency can help. Will there be a mechanism whereby the applicant requires some permitting before it's constructed?
Madam, my understanding is actually that this is on an ordinary watercourse rather than a main river. So it's probably a matter for the joint councils. I think we've previously tried to assist in terms of advising on design and those sorts of issues, but we're not party to the Section 106, and it's not envisaged that we would play quite the role that you're outlining.
So can I just be clear what the process would be with regards to that? There'd be some design carried out by the applicant in consultation with Natural England, and then it would come to the joint councils?
I think we'd be better hearing from the applicant as to how they envisage it taking place. We've expressed a willingness to accept this as an obligation to help facilitate these works taking place, but I'm sure that the applicant will have a better idea of what they intend to be the process than us.
I'll hear from the applicant first, but Mr. Moulin, I can see that you're... and I know you offered at the previous hearing to assist with this.
Madam, this proposal is as a result of discussions with Natural England regarding an existing weir which doesn't perform a good enough function. We've had a discussion with the Environment Agency, and then they've advised that the design has to take account of, I think, eel movements and allow their movement through it. Obviously, we need an IDB consent to do the works. So we will obviously discuss with the relevant parties the detailed design, but the predominant driver for wanting this weir is Natural England to do with water levels and the SSSI, so they'll be the primary consultee.
That's very helpful, thank you. Mr. Moulin?
Yes, so I can add to that. The appropriate partnership there would be North Somerset Levels Internal Drainage Board, and I think there have been ongoing discussions about water level management, and I think this has been seen as an opportunity to contribute towards that, which is welcomed.
Thank you. Moving to Portbury Wharf, I think we have covered that previously. So just so I'm clear, the commitment for the ecological clerk of works for that site is in the BMS.
Yes, Madam, paragraph 2.4.73.
And I did read that you'd changed some of the wording there in anticipation of a possible change of land ownership. But it did seem to me that there was still a commitment to the Avon Wildlife Trust. And whilst the local authority said that Avon Wildlife Trust may well be involved in the ongoing management, they didn't tell us that that trust definitely would be. So I don't know whether you just want to look at that wording again or whether you're satisfied with the way it is at the moment.
Yes, Madam. I mean, I think, as was perhaps indicated on Monday, we have been seeking to agree various matters and enter into an agreement with the Wildlife Trust. We've actually found it very difficult to get any response from them at all. We're, I think, still trying to pursue that, but in a sense, it's difficult to make progress if, for whatever reason, they're unwilling or unable to cooperate. So we will just try to pursue the points and reach agreement with them.
My question was more whether you might consider removing the definitiveness of your current wording with regards to Avon Wildlife Trust in case the local authority decided to manage it through a different organisation?
Madam, that is certainly a point worth worth considering, and we'll have a look at the wording. I mean, our objective is absolutely clear on this. We just need to be able to work with a body that's willing to work with us, or I don't think they're unwilling, but is able to work with us.
But if the land ownership did change to the local authority, and they then wanted to commit with another organisation, then the BMS, as it stands at present, would mean that the funding would go to the Avon Wildlife Trust. So I'm just trying to ensure that the local authority has the flexibility it needs.
Yes, well, I think the best thing for us to do is take on board that frankly very helpful point, and just make sure that the wording works in all circumstances.
Thank you. And perhaps you can update me on the Mendips Hills AOMB. There was, in their statement of common ground, there was...
Yes, madam. Some of this, because the Mendips Hills AOMB package, in a sense, your heading brings together various things. So there are certain OSPES works in the Mendip Hills AONB, and they will be reflected in the Section 106 Agreement, Schedule 9, Part A. So, which is off-site planting. So some of that will relate to Mendip Hills. There is also, of course, some public rights of way works. Some of those, again, in the Mendip Hills, and Schedule 9, Part D, long distance routes and public rights of way, will capture those. And I think the headings in that part of the Section 106 agreement, Schedule 9, in effect reflected the headings or the way things were divided up in the OSPES itself.
So your
position... In the OSPES itself, in Section 7, the headings there were things like planting and access and signage and so on. And I think, to the best of my understanding, the Section 106 Schedule 9 headings broadly reflect that breakdown. So those things should be included, but just not kind of separated out into AONB points.
So my recollection is that the AOMB board had asked for a lump sum in the Statement of Common Ground. We haven't had a response in terms of clarifying what that sum was. It was, I think the term that was used was something like diversionary measures from the construction stage activities. Your position was set out very clearly in, I think, response to first round questions or early on in the examination process,
yes,
that you didn't consider it was relevant or necessary. So I just want to clarify that position remains.
Yes, insofar as we think it's necessary to contribute to public rights of way works, that will be reflected in the relevant part of Schedule 9 and the monies to be paid in respect of public rights of way.
Thank you. That's everything I have, but I would just thank both parties for getting the Section 106 agreement to us last night, because it has saved a lot of time. So I think Ms. Mackay will now lead on the Community Impact Mitigation Fund.
Right, we've heard a lot about this, obviously, at the hearings and also in writing. I just wanted to ask the Joint Councils, you did provide a list of Hinkley Point C finance projects at deadline 4, and the applicant has taken those as supporting its own case that such a fund isn't required in this instance. I wondered if the Joint Councils could provide me with a comment in response to that, in particular as to the relevance to planning of some of the projects that have been quoted.
Yes, thank you, madam. I'll start from the beginning. The Hinkley Point C Kim Fund has been in operation since June last year. There have been 5 rounds of applications so far, and the projects which have been funded to date were set out within the note. We have looked at the applicant's response to those projects. I didn't furnish you with all of the details on those projects because the files are about that big and they sit on my colleague's desk. For example, one of the projects had about 93 documents submitted with the project. What I was asked to do was provide you with a summary. Mm-hmm. So it's not, I appreciate that it's not necessarily within the applicant's gift to go and read all of those 93 documents and get their head around all of those individual projects. The projects that have come forward to date are, in the main, reasonably large capital projects. What I would say is they are located in the communities which are likely to be the most affected by the Hinkley Point C project. The geography of the Kim Fund for the last year has specifically been skewed in favour of that. The projects that have come forward recognise the long lead-in time that some of these community-based projects take to deliver. They seek to provide match funding in a good number of cases, and the applicants within those communities are now busy in most cases trying to secure the other match funding in order to bring about the delivery of those projects. This is quite a coordinated and collaborative approach to providing funding. There are some projects which seek to address a wide range of community-based issues and concerns, and the reality is, as can be seen from the list, that those do it almost inevitably in some cases revolve around the delivery of initiatives via renewed or extended village halls and the like. That's not by any stretch of the imagination the limit to what the Kim Fund in relation to Hinkley Point C is about. It's for potentially a wide range of socio-economic and environmental-based projects. We are working with a whole range of communities, and there have been well over 100 expressions of interest in relation to the Hinkley Point C Kim Fund. Some of those are at various stages of development, and the suite of projects which is likely to come forward and be funded from that Kim Fund will hopefully become a little more varied as we move on. I repeat again the reality of the kind of
the long lead-in time type projects that have been funded to date. That's not deliberate or by design, it's just the reality of what's taken place to date. We believe, and the governance indeed allows this, the governance actively encourages EDF Energy to play its part in the consideration of each and every one of those applications, the ones that have been approved and refused. Whilst it's a board discussion and there are eight people on the board, four organisations, two votes each, the vast, vast majority of those applications on the list which has been provided to you have been unanimous decisions, so with the blessing of EDF Energy, who would have, I'm sure, expressed their discontent or objection should they have considered that any of those projects didn't meet the objectives set out in their Section 106 agreement. You'll be reasonably unsurprised to hear, I'm sure, that the criteria that we're proposing in relation to this KIM fund is very, very similar to the criteria in relation to the Hinkley Point C KIM fund, save for the fact that the geography is clearly different. So the applicant's response to this in kind of summing up in terms of answering your question, it was relatively short, and I appreciate the paper which was provided to them was relatively short, so it's not surprising that they haven't necessarily got their heads around all of the different projects and the understand the relationship between the impacts which EDF's project is likely to cause and those projects are seeking to address. Clearly could go on. I don't suppose you want me to, but that's probably where we are. We hadn't necessarily intended on making any great sweeping written submission to counter what the applicant has said. They're entitled to their view. EDF and the three councils involved in that project were obviously supportive, as I've said a moment ago, almost entirely unanimously in favour of considering those projects as appropriate in terms of the criteria. So there's not a great deal more for me to say.
Mr. Humphreys, the panel did ask a question on the KIM fund, and in the light of the proposal for the applicant to have been involved in administration and perhaps potential scope for funds to be repaid in the event that they weren't utilised as envisaged, would that not safeguard the applicant's fears over this issue, that it wouldn't be used compliant with EN1?
Madam, no, and I'm certainly aware from discussions when the council were discussing this with us that the council were absolutely opposed to the idea that monies might be returned to us. They made it very clear in negotiations, Mr. Best can confirm this, that the monies that went into the KIM fund were theirs then to do with as they wished, and that would continue not just the construction period but for the full life of the project, and it would be spent. So we had our misgivings in any event about the requirements in EN 1 and particular paragraph 4.1.8, I think it is, and wanted to justify those, but we did at least explore ourselves the very point that you've just put to me, and that was absolutely rejected, very firmly rejected. Just generally, I would say that our position, I hope, is sort of set out in the answers to those various questions, and also the particular appendix you've referred to in document 8. 18 to one. Madam, I think in a sense that sort of, you know, encompasses our position. I hope what the Section 106 agreement does demonstrate, and the schedules to it does demonstrate, however, is that where we've been able to identify particular impacts and identify mitigation or offsetting measures that relate to those particular impacts, National Grid has been very willing to fund those. And you can see that the sums of money in the Section 106 agreement are actually very substantial indeed. And National Grid is perfectly content to provide those monies as mitigation or offsetting to, you know, particular impacts in relation to particular communities or community assets such as footpaths and so on. What we've made it very clear, however, that we're not prepared to do is just have a sort of generalised multi-million pound fund that is handed over to be just dealt with by the council, whether in consultation with us or otherwise, because we don't think that passes the test that you and the Secretary of State is required to apply. And the Secretary of State wouldn't have put those tests in the national policy statement unless he expected the examining authority and parties to comply with it. And that's our position. And as for the Hinkley Point generating station, it may be that the circumstances were different there, but we have to face the circumstances that face us.
And can I just to confirm that the applicant's position is that there are no residual adverse impacts that have not yet come to light that would justify a payment in the light of EN1?
Well, madam, the environmental statement has to identify likely significant effects. It has done that. It's clear from that, and as I've said on previous occasions, and is recognised in the MPS as well, that there will be residual effects. It's very clear from the MPS EN5 that government doesn't contemplate a situation where there are no residual effects. Indeed, that's why government makes it very clear that there is a balancing exercise, and that balancing exercise is, if you like, encapsulated in section 104.3 and section 104.7 of the Planning Act 2008, which makes it very clear that the adverse effects of the scheme, clearly recognising that there may be some, have to be, in my shorthand, weighed against the benefits as set out in the national policy statement. And as I referred to in a different context earlier, and obviously for perfectly proper reasons we haven't really discussed need, but in document 8.4a, which is the updated need statement, the need is set out, and that includes providing transmission network support for not only Hinkley Point C, but other generating capacity that is proposed and may also be proposed in the future in the southwest. And so there is that balancing exercise. I'm not aware of any infrastructure project that I've ever been involved in over 30 years that has had no residual impacts. That's the nature of the planning exercise, and it is the same here. As to whether there are unidentified ones, again, that's the Rumsfeld unknown unknowns. As far as we're aware, we have identified all of them, and that is what we're required to do as part of the environmental statement. We can't really properly mitigate for impacts that we simply don't know about, and indeed it's difficult to see how those could properly pass the test in EN1 paragraph 4.1.8. How could the payment reasonably relate The words are directly, there must be relevant to planning, necessary to make the proposed development acceptable in planning terms, directly related to the proposed development, fairly and reasonably related to the scale and kind of proposed development, and reasonable in all other respects. How could it be reasonable if we simply didn't know what the impact was? And as I hope I've made clear earlier, where impacts have been identified, we have been very quick to propose Section 106 payments, very quick indeed. There's been no sort of difficulty there. It's a question of identifying what is right.
Thank you. Mr. Moulin.
Yes, I have made some written comments, as amongst many others, on this topic. Let's start with over the last 5 years, what the community has, or communities have got used to. I'll have to be careful how I just, let's say the consultation process and the information coming from National Grid. There has been an expectation that there would be a means for the community to tap in to funds to look, which would cover a number of residual impacts. And I think they have in mind, we've talked about a number of things here. Let's talk about, for example, traffic movements. There's going to be certain communities that are going to be impacted by those. I don't think in what has been proposed there's anything related to that. That's why I have made comments about carbon offsetting, whether that has actually been considered in you know, as a means of mitigating that and letting the community have the benefit of that, because the community will suffer from traffic movements in certain areas. I mentioned too about the tree planting scheme, in that respect, again, I'm not convinced that actually the full mitigation for that will be able to be taken place with a voluntary agreement, but again, other ways maybe of meeting that through other things. What the community got used to the idea was National Grid actually saying, look, this is going to have an impact, we understand about all your concerns, but we're going to put it back better, we're going to enhance. And I think there is that sort of expectation that goes with this development. And I know it's a difficult thing when you're looking at the legislation about what is reasonable and so forth, but let's look at some of the other examples. Bristol Airport, for example, recognised the impact, although it didn't have to, in the sense that it met planning requirements for noise and things. Nonetheless, it did say we will set up a community fund, which does run. It has as part of it noise attenuation measures that local residents can apply for, but it provides for funds for wider issues than that. It is an ongoing fund. There are many other of these examples that you can find, and I think to myself, well, if they have been allowed through planning, then there's no reason why, with a little bit of creativity, we can't look at something here. So the other examples my members have quoted to me is in relation to solar parks and planning. Recently I was involved in discussion about a solar park being put near the Strawberry Line in the parish of Congsbury. And it was interesting there that what goes with these schemes, there's some sort of trade-off with the fit, and there are certain one-off sums made to parish and town councils as a result. They are community funds. So it's a generally recognised thing. And I would just ask that National Grid looks at the picture, the wider picture, the statements that they have made through the whole consultation process, and look to the mitigation in its fullest sense, which is to actually enhance. I would think there are plenty of safeguards that could be put on such a scheme. It could link it to environmental benefits, to the things we've talked about. It could be limited within a certain corridor, and it could be made available to those communities, towns and parish councils along that route. And even if, can I say, it was just a one-off payment in recognition to those communities, just in the same way as a solar park would do it, over a, I don't know, four-year period or whatever the period of time is, then I think the community would respond very positively to that, and it would be a good way of sealing this whole project in the public's eyes. I think that's all I'd like to say on that. Thanks.
Thank you. Sue Hayes.
Thank you, Sue Hayes, Badgerworth Parish Council. We get asked, the Parish Council gets asked, what's the benefit to us? We know from Mr. Humphrey's statements, several statements have been made, this is for the good of the nation. That's all well and good. But what does the local communities get out of it, who have to host this infrastructure? The works in Tarnock and the effects of Bidisham are well recorded in our responses. The ES assessments that Mr. Humphreys refers to, we haven't agreed with. You have those responses. They're all residual effects of negligible or minor. Tarnock has to host an overhead haul road to the north, and the erection of those pylons and the removal of that line. The works access to the two works compounds for the overhead line and the undergrounding works, 159 movements a day through that access. The ceiling end compound and its temporary works compound, all going through Tarnock and across opposite to Bidisham. The permanent bridge, the temporary bridge, the haul road to serve the overhead line construction to the south. That starts in 2018. We haven't had an answer as to whether the haul road actually starts prior to that date, so there could well be an impact of longer than the 2 years that the construction programme actually says. We've talked about the construction hours, and we await to find out exactly whether that's going to be as proposed and agreed. We have no benefit from this scheme whatsoever. We do have community improvements that we could put forward. Indeed, we have put forward a suggestion to the local councils. And the suggestions that we couldn't possibly afford as we are now, and therefore we find that the KIM fund would help us most significantly to achieve some of those aims. Thank you.
Thank you. The joint councils.
Thank you. Can I just turn immediately to Mr. Humphrey's comments around the monies being returned? I guess, being completely honest, some things which are said in the heat of debate and discussion about particularly contentious issues occasionally confuse things. The councils are absolutely content with the prospect that if a KIM fund was secured through an obligation, that if monies within it remained unspent within a particular period of time, then those monies would be returned to the developer. That is exactly what three of the six councils have signed up to in relation to the Hinkley Point C project, so I've absolutely no reason to suspect that a similar form of wording couldn't be eased into drafting on this particular project. I think on behalf of the joint councils, the applicants during the various hearings and in writing have made representations which arguably confuse the debate and occasionally seek to discredit the council's case regarding the principle of a Kim fund. These have ranged from a suggestion that the joint councils might be asking the applicant to buy consent, comments that National Grid already operate a scheme which will deliver similar outcomes, and most recently misleading remarks in a written answer about the commitments of government to deliver community benefits via the retention of business rates from generating power stations. The applicants have also sought to suggest during hearings in response to the Joint Council's case to question the governance of any fund and the purposes to which any fund might be applied. Mr. Humphreys continues to call it a general fund for general things. The Somerset authorities have an active KIM fund, as you know, in relation to the EDF project, and the governance proposed here is very similar, as I said. It simply reflects the different geography of this project. Those proposals for governance have been shared with the applicant for a considerable period of time and were made clear to the panel within Appendix C of the Joint Council's Local Impact Report in February. We've had no response to that, as far as I'm aware. I have explained in response to questions from the panel the process by which projects are judged, and we have invited National Grid to be part of this to ensure that any fund is not misapplied. The Community Impact Mitigation Fund, which is what it suggests, it's a fund for communities to mitigate the impacts that this project will cause within those communities. The Joint Councils and National Grid, if they wish to accept the invitation, would have an administrative role. It would be, in our view, secured by a Section 106 development consent obligation. As we've said previously, the principle of fund has been established on another local, nationally significant infrastructure project, and I'm heartened in this regard regarding the issue of principle by the fact that the other promoter, EDF Energy, were advised during the consultation phase and the DCO examination into that project by Mr. Philpott, who would, I am sure, have advised EDF not to include the KIM fund within their Section 106 agreement if it were somehow inappropriate or indeed illegal. On that project, the councils were able to take our own advice from leading council, who was perfectly satisfied with the prospect of a KIM fund, as indeed was the Secretary of State, who didn't remove it as part of the DCO decision. We have heard just recently a little from the parish councils and other representatives about hosting. That is something that's a little different, and I don't wish for that to be confused with the KIM fund. The applicants have, for their own reasons, never engaged with the joint councils regarding an amount within the KIM fund, and the joint councils have set out there in detail their justification for the amount sought within Appendix C of the local impact report, citing other transmission and long linear projects, both within the UK and internationally. We haven't simply referred to the Hinkley Point C project. The councils have consistently and repeatedly explained the rationale for the KIM fund, which arises from a range of residual adverse impacts which arise from the project. We continue to believe that there are individual and cumulative impacts where National Grid's proposed mitigation is inadequate. Adverse impacts which are understated, unforeseen or poorly predicted, and residual unmitigated effects. There have been occasions within this examination where these instances have been explored. Yesterday, for example, we looked at the detail at Factory Lane, where, in summary, a Bright Ideas workshop has achieved very little. At Tarnock, where engineering requirements mean that no measures in favour of individual properties can be offered. We have also had explanations setting out that normal working practices for linear connection projects should be applied here, and that will include working on all but 2 days in a month.
and the obvious contrast with the public's reasonable expectations to enjoy their properties. During the issue-specific hearing in relation to socioeconomics and other matters, I confess to having lost count of the number of times the detailed questions about the assessment of impact revealed a residual minor adverse effect. As a panel, you've asked the applicant very pointedly in relation to one section of this project a question which started, "The examining authority seriously disagrees with the environmental statement assessment of the effect of the project." The response that there will be a moderate adverse effect was, from my perspective, regrettably predictable. The applicant, in response to your question, which was 216.4 about the Kim Fund and the residual impacts of the project, said, "The residual impacts of the proposed project must, of course, be weighed against the very considerable need and benefits of the scheme as set out in the National Policy Statements EN1 and EN5, and as further articulated in the applicant's need case. It's National Grid's case that the need and benefits of the proposed project clearly outweigh its residual adverse effects for the purposes of Section 104 of the Planning Act 2008, which is in a short form what Mr. Humphreys just said. Section 104 of the Act and EN1 state that the Secretary of State must decide an application in accordance with the relevant MPS, except to the extent that you are satisfied to so do, would, amongst other things, result in adverse impacts from the development outweighing the benefits. This decision clearly requires a weighting exercise to be undertaken, and it's our contention that a Kim Fund assists in ensuring that a significant number of residual effects from this project are not simply swept aside by the applicant's trump card, as they see it, regarding the need for the project. In our view, the rationale and justification for a Kim Fund remains strong in light of the number and seriousness of a range of impacts in a range of locations." I've nearly finished. "The position that we find ourselves in is that the applicant has steadfastly refused to include provision for a Kim Fund within the Section 106 agreement, which was provided to the panel yesterday, and repeatedly has invited the Joint Councils to put their case to the Secretary of State. Recognising that it is you as a panel who makes your recommendation to the Secretary of State, the Joint Councils will, of course, continue to put our case in writing, and we would very much hope that our case is clear. As you've heard from Mr. Riley, we intend on making a written submission at deadline 6, and on this and other matters where National Grid have indicated that they are not going to enter into an agreement under 106. This will be a series of schedules in a style of a 106 agreement, and we request, as Mr. Riley has already done, that the panel consults upon this submission at the time it consults on the 106 agreement. Our submission will also respectfully ask that within your report to the Secretary of State, on your findings and conclusion in respect of each of the not agreed schedules, would, if included in a supplemental 106, to secure mitigation which is necessary and proportionate to address the impacts of the project." You'd be unsurprised to hear that you might be getting a version of that at deadline 6.
Thank you. Mr. Parker.
Thank you. I'd nearly forgotten what I was going to say after that. Thank you. I find it very difficult. I'm representing a parish council. We're not statutory consultees. We're told at these meetings that it would be beneficial for us to be here, and thank you for coming along. What we seem to be getting from it as a parish council is not a lot. I'm not involved in a 106. I don't know what the 106 has been signed, how it affects our community, whether we're involved or whether we're not. I just don't know. AOMB, which forms a major part of our parish, has submitted something for a 106, and I agree with Mr. Humphreys that asking for a lump of money is not satisfactory. You need to define what it is. I don't know what the AOMB had in mind for that. I just don't know. I hear also that as far as the hosting of various things in a parish doesn't count for much. I have an M5 motorway which drones away all day and all night. I have a rat run going through the parish. I have the A38, which drones from about 4 o'clock in the morning going to Bristol Airport, and Bristol Airport provides a frequent flight over the parish, which causes noise, blots out the sun with their exhaust fumes. We host that as well. We also host a main road which links Cheddar Quarry to the M5 South, which drones away. Okay, it doesn't drone away all the time, but the significant lorries cause damage to the roads. It causes damage to people when they knock them down off their bicycles and people can't walk on the road. I asked for 106, asked for mitigation. I don't get anything. We are not going to benefit from this going on. We're going to have huge pylons. The public have been misguided, I believe, on the size of the pylons and the impact on the infrastructure, on the community, on the landscape. And what are we going to get from it? Nothing. I don't want money. I don't want money. There are a few things I could do. I could make cycling safer for our community going, if they want to go into our main key rural settlement, which is Axbridge or Cheddar, to do their shopping. I could help them walk safely. There is no safe footpath to walk between Cross, the edge of the Compton Bishop Parish, and Axbridge and Cheddar. There are some things I could do. I don't think I stand a hope in hell of getting any money for that from any of the councils or from National Grid or anybody else. So I sit here thinking, why am I here? And I think that all these people who are going to infect our parishes with this infrastructure should just take a step back and say, you know, what can I do as a mitigation against these things that we're going to put in your community, and for all the effect we're going to have for 45 months of continuous working, going up the haul roads, down the haul roads, moving earth, storing earth, getting it out and putting it back again, directional drilling. We're going to have a nightmare, and we don't really count. That's what we feel. The people do not count. You've got a process which is going on which ignores the people. And that's where I think I will rest my case before I get too wound up. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Parker. Ms. Early.
I don't wish to waste everyone's time by repeating the points my other people around the table have made. I just wanted to add to that by pointing out that many of us and others who are not here today attended the community forums, exhibitions and whatnot, and I would concur with Mr. Moulin that the expectation was that there would be some kind of community fund available. So that's one thing I wanted to say. I also wanted to add to the Joint Council's examples by just considering not the West End of Nailsea, which we've talked about many times before, and we understand the impact of the construction period on those people who will be completely surrounded, but just to think about the wider community of Nailsea. As we've identified, the primary route into Nailsea is the B3130 through Tickenham. That is going to have its own construction effects going on there. And so in terms of the road impacts, the travel impacts on a daily basis for anybody who lives anywhere in Nailsea, they will be affected by that road daily. I include myself in that. Most people use that road to go out to Clevedon or the motorway to get to their workplaces if they don't use the train. So when we think about the cumulative effects on Nailsea, particularly those people in the West End, they're going to have 6 months of construction of underground grounding. They're going to have the additional months of construction of the pylons, all of which will affect their roads locally in Nailsea. And then on top of that, they're going to have 6 months of undergrounding work going on in Tickenham and the overhead line that will be put up there. And those are not going to overlap in total. I'm sure some of it will. So there's a huge impact on people locally, in addition to the hours and so on that everybody else has talked about. And I just feel that there is certainly justification for some kind of community return. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Moulin.
Thank you. Yes, I'd just like to add, just by way of illustration, I think the Section 106 process, if you were looking at a development at parish level, normally the parish council would have some say in what the particular requirements of that community are in relation to a particular development. Now, in this case, of course, it's not at that level at all. And in addition, because of all the comments made here, as I said, in terms of expectation, we were looking at a project which, yes, was national, but was touching the hearts and the lives of people locally. And I just want to give an example just to say that how real this was in the early stages. In my written submissions on behalf of our group, for the first couple of years of consultation process, I was talking with a member of the project team about these ideas that could be converted into action locally. And in those discussions, I was minded of what were, if you like, reasonable requirements in terms of planning. And there's no doubt in my mind, and it's in my written submissions, that some of these ideas would fit in with Section 106 if you were looking at it at a local level. And I just feel that certainly in the spirit of democracy, I'm not, and I respect the situation we find ourselves in with the joint councils getting together to do what they're doing with the Section 106 agreement. And it's welcome, those monies are welcome, but I think we're looking at something more here in addition to what would perhaps be normal infrastructure sort of arrangements, which, yes, they do address some of the mitigation, but not down at the local level of a parish and a town. That is the residual element that we would put to you as the panel to say, in law, can that be recognised? And we had asked that recommendation would be given to the Secretary of State about that impact. These things are very difficult to define, but I hope you can see from what we've said today that they actually do mean something. Thank you.
Thank you. Joint councils.
Just a really small point. The examples that we've shared with you, you probably see from that the parish councils in the case of those projects have played a really significant role in the development of those projects for their communities. And I don't think it's wrong to say that a lot of the parish councils and community representatives felt exactly the same at the end of the Hinkley Point C examination, whereby they had issues which hadn't gone their way. I believe, having worked with them for the last 6 or so years, and particularly since the Kim Fund was secured and has been in play, that actually that they've been able to move on from accepting the need to host this infrastructure from a national need perspective, and the Kim Fund has provided an outlet for them to think about how they can enhance their communities in places which are affected and where there are residual impacts which can't be addressed. So this, without wishing to sound too clever, is a definite working solution to some of the problems that keep arising time and time again and keep being articulated by the parishes and the community representatives. So they've identified a whole series of problems. We are trying to identify a solution by which can address those problems. It's not perfect. We don't have all the answers here and now, but there's a definite worked up deliverable process which is in play and is achieving results.
Thank you. Mr. Humphreys, do you want to respond on behalf of the applicant?
Yes, madam. Let me put a few things into context. First, very early on, Mr. Moulin made some
points quite properly about the experience at Bristol and there being a fund and the communities being able to draw on that. Of course, that exists for this project also. It's not something we rely on. It's not in the Section 106 agreement. But of course, the paper that we put in as an appendix in document 8.18.2.1 told you, and you'd been told in other contexts earlier, about National Grid's general community fund that parties can draw on, bringing energy to life fund, where there is a central fund where communities can apply to fund community projects, and that fund is specifically for areas where National Grid's work has the potential to affect local people. However, we have not laid great emphasis on that because we don't think that it relates to particular impacts. We have not asked you to place reliance on it because we think that fund, although it exists and although communities do apply for funds on it, doesn't pass the tests of being, for my shorthand, necessarily related, sufficiently closely related to the particular impacts. But of course, such a fund does exist and will continue to exist. Second point, it's easy in all of this to lose sight of the tens of millions of pounds of mitigation that is in fact embedded in the scheme. As part of the overall optioneering, National Grid chose an alignment for the line which followed an existing line and has allowed us to take down the existing 132 kV line. Indeed, in some areas, we're taking down two existing 132 kV lines. And therefore, this is not a case where the impact that is suffered is a net additional impact. There is actually a balance with the benefits from reducing the existing line. And not in all cases, but in a large proportion of the cases, the very communities that will suffer the permanent impact of having a line there are the very communities that will also have the benefit of the removal of the existing line. Of course, one is bigger than the other, but there is a balance there, and that was done as part of embedded mitigation. Also, it's important to remember the embedded mitigation in the proposed undergrounding. Not only the undergrounding through the AONB, where there is an existing overhead line which will be removed, but also the other areas of undergrounding, near, for example, to Nailsea, where two lines will be taken down, closer to homes in that area, and in other parts of the line as well. We discussed the undergrounding up in Section F on Monday as well. The next thing to bear in mind, therefore, is that in looking at the mitigation that it thinks appropriate, and I'll try not to repeat points I've made earlier, we have had regard to the guidance in the MPS, and we also have to have regard to the fact that National Grid is a regulated company. It has to justify its expenditure, and that would again, to the best of my knowledge, be a contrast with a company like Bristol Airport, which I think for these purposes is not a regulated entity, or at least certainly not in the same in the same way. Now, a lot of the comments have been that, well, look, the nation shares the benefits, we suffer the impacts. And of course, to some extent, that is true. But residents in this part of the country also share those national benefits in energy security and so on, just as much as everybody else. Also, residents here, and it's, I suppose, a statement of the blindingly obvious, also have the benefit of infrastructure in other parts of the country where it's other communities that benefit from them, people that perhaps fly from Heathrow Airport or use rail lines that go through other communities or use water facilities, reservoirs, all of those sorts of things. It's in the nature of infrastructure planning that it does have particular impacts on particular areas, but it does have much wider impacts, and I'm afraid there's nothing we can do about that. What we have sought to do, though, is identify, both through our own work, but also with the joint councils, actual impacts, and where we're able to, and it's appropriate, mitigate or offset from those. And I've said before, we have no problem doing that at all. Our Section 106 agreement reflects that. There are very substantial sums of money being paid over to mitigate actual effects. Our difficulty is with effects that the council just have not been able to justify to us. They just have not been able to point to something and say this is the way it should be mitigated. And if we were asked to ask now in the Kim scheme what schemes would it be paying for, they can talk about the sorts of things, but they can't point to a particular expenditure on money that is mitigating a particular impact. And that is where we feel we part company with them on that. The Joint Councils referred to Section 104.3 and 104.7, as I did, although I didn't think they named 104.7 quite as explicitly, but that was the subtext to what was being said about balances. And that was the balance I referred to of benefits and impacts. But a Kim fund that does not actually mitigate a particular impact, it's very difficult to see how that can weigh in that balance. What impact is being mitigated that then has less weight when weighed against the benefit of the scheme? That's one of the problems with this type of a generalized, slightly more amorphous fund that is not related to particular impacts. Next point, Mr. Parker was making a point later about, look, you know, do people count? Yes, of course people count. Very much do they count. That is why we have gone through a process over many years to try to refine the route. We have had a process that has constantly forced us to back check. We've had change request procedures. We have changed alignments. We've changed pylon locations. We've done a very large range of things to try and mitigate the effects. Up in the Portishead, Portbury area, we brought forward two particular alignments. Might be said it would have been easier for us to do one. We did that because we realized that we're finely balanced competing interests. We expressed a preference because that's what guidance tells us we ought to do, but we have given the option so that others can weigh that particular balance. The important thing is people do count, and we have tried to take them into account, but we are charged with delivering the connection of the Hinkley Point power station, and that is what we have to do, and we have done it in the most appropriate, sympathetic way that that we are able. Yes, the final point, repeatedly people make the point that the impacts are huge. Madam, the impacts need to be assessed properly. Of course, we understand that people feel strongly about this, but the impacts need to be assessed and weighed properly. We have tried to do that by reference to the best guidance, for example, the Glivia guidance on landscape and visual impact. And the reason for following that sort of guidance is that it does, insofar as it's possible to do so, try to remove subjectivity and introduce greater objectivity in what, at the end of the day, are obviously professional judgments. The judgments we've come up to, it may be that the panel will say they don't agree with. We, of course, understand that, but they are the professional judgments of people who spent a lot of time looking at this, and they stand by their assessments. And it's just not right, therefore, we would say, to say that all the impacts are huge. All the impacts are not huge. The impacts are set out in the environmental statement, and we say that they are easily outweighed by the need and the benefits of the project.
Thank you. Ms. Early.
Just a couple of further points that came to my mind as I was listening there. Firstly, just a little clarification on the porpory options. I believe it's correct to say that they were not options. The second option came up and was imposed on porpory, so it's a little disingenuous to use that as an applicant's positive effort there when that's not how things occurred. The second thing is that I wanted to raise the point about mitigating a particular impact of a community. Funds such as this was able to mitigate a particular impact. If the community could come up with that idea, that seems a little strange to me. I would have thought that it was behovent on the applicant National Grid to come up with mitigating impacts. And the whole point of this is that we're not able to mitigate impacts, except possibly with undergrounding or undersea, which are not now being considered. And so, therefore, it is not possible to directly mitigate. And as I said, National Grid should have come up with those and have looked to mitigate where they can within the possibilities that there are. The final point I wanted to make that I have just remembered, when the Bristol Airport Fund was mentioned as being run by Bristol Airport, that reminded me that we specifically discussed in the community forum that any such community impact mitigation fund would be independently run and not by National Grid. Thank you.
Thank you. Does anyone else want to say anything on the community impact fund? Now, on the agenda, we have two final matters, which we can probably deal with together. Any other measures and any other matters? Does anyone have anything else to raise under those? Mr. Riley.
Maybe not under those specific topics, but just two things perhaps to capture before we finish. One was that we've had an update from North Somerset on the Portbury Wharf bird deflectors question, and I wondered if now might be a good time just to give you those pylon numbers, if I may. So North Somerset say that if option B is the chosen route, the bird deflectors should be positioned between pylons P-LD95, just north of the M5, to P-LD120, which is just west of the dock.
Thank you. Okay.
The second point I wanted to flag for us to discuss before we leave today was just the timing of submissions and what was coming in at deadline 6, because we've flagged a lot of items for addressing over the next few days, and I think it's worth clarifying what's coming in when to you.
Thank you. Were you going to do that, Mr. Ryan?
Well, no, I think it's... we know what we've got to put in as a result.
So you know what you're providing.
We do,
providing.
Really,
so
I suppose. It was an indirect way of asking the applicant what they're intending to put in at deadline 6 and what they may ask you to exercise your discretion on, right, if they know.
I don't know if you have the response available now. I know that action point lists are being worked on at the moment, and they will be published as soon as possible on the website. I appreciate we're rapidly approaching that particular deadline.
While people are talking about that, could I just query the numbers of those pylons, please? The second one, P-LD120, did you say?
That's what I've been given, but if there's a question around it,
I think it might be 102. 120 is over in Avonmouth. It's. it's not a P. It's not a P one.
Well, should we work on the assumption of 102, and I'll just confirm that's the case when we put our.
Yeah, I think you'll need to, because I think there is a 102 A, B, C, and maybe D. I mean, why don't you just simply come back to us?
Yes, we will. Thank you.
I just had one, just one moment, Miss Early. I had one point just left over from this morning. The Environment Agency, I did have a note that you were continuing discussions with the proposed disapplication of your flood defence bylaws. I don't know if you can update me on that.
I can put that down. I was going to raise that point. Yes, we did say in our letter of the 4th of June that we would update you. We have been in discussions with the applicant to trim down effectively the number of bylaws which they are seeking to disapply. I think it's fair to say that we've made good progress on that, which will be reflected in the new version of the DCO. And the other benefit in relation to that is actually it trims down the areas that we need to address our minds on protective provisions. So the news from us is positive in that regard.
Right, thank you. Miss Early.
Thank you. Just a couple of things that I wanted to point out, and I'm happy to put them in writing too. I don't know if the panel is aware, but in May this year, there was a group of scientists, of which there are now 200 around the world, have signed up to a paper that has gone to the UN and to the World Health Organization, and it covers their concern about EMF issues. And specifically, there's a lot I can quote, and I'm not going to do it. I'm happy to provide it to everyone. But the sort of summary sentence that I've picked out is that they state, the various agencies setting safety standards have failed to impose sufficient guidelines to protect the general public, particularly children who are more vulnerable to the effects of EMF. But there's a call for more research in this area by the concerns of what's going on. So I'm happy to send you that for inclusion by tomorrow's deadline. The second thing I wanted to question, really, to ask for clarification, and I know it was answered in the second round of questions, is about the overall costs, please. And I did understand that there was an amount of 50.2 million, which is in question number 2.3.9, which covers costs of payments, disturbance, injurious affection, and so on, related to professional fees. And the question was, does that figure need to be revised? And National Grid said no. So I would like to ask whether that has been whether there's any change to that. As part of that question, I'd also like to say, is that included? Earlier, it talks about 750 million being the total costs of the project now. And is that 50 million number included in that 750, or is it additional? And I'd also like to ask whether there are any other additional costs that are not included in those two sums, whether it's 750 million or 800 million now in total. Are there other sums? I'm thinking about whether there's compulsory purchase orders, whether there are other such inducements, whether there are other such professional fees, indeed whether there's the whole consultation fees. Trying to find the all-inclusive number, if that could be provided. Thank you very much.
Questions have been asked in relation to costs in second round questions.
And I think we have answered those. I think Dr. Pratt raised a lot of these questions, and we responded to those. I don't think there's anything more that we need to say on that. As far as groups of scientists on EMF calling for further research, groups of scientists often call for further research. We have complied with the guidance relevant in the UK as set out in NPS EN1. We had a session where we had the experts here to talk about EMF. I've got nothing further to add on that.
I'm sorry, I'm still not clear whether that 50 million is included in the 750 million.
Well, we've given a written answer on this.
Right. If there's nothing else that anyone wants to raise, then it just leads me to formally close the hearing. As I mentioned in opening, this is the final hearing to take place in the examination process. So the panel would very much like to express its gratitude, firstly to Andrew Weaver and all at Copper Consultancy for the projections and document management. Certainly the speed with which they've retrieved various plans for us has been most impressive. And also to Ben and all at Production 78 for the audio and all the help provided during the hearings, which again has been excellent. And then finally to all the participants at the hearings, not only for the quality of the evidence provided, but also for the way in which they've conducted themselves. And certainly in saying that, we particularly appreciate that those representing the parish councils and voluntary organisations, they've very much done so in their own time and had to engage with a process with which they've not been familiar. And certainly they've done so in a most admirable and eloquent fashion. So thank you to everyone. The hearing is now closed, and I wish you a safe journey home.